This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO series from 1998.
Yeah.
I'm Andrew, and I'm delighted to say that I am joined today by
Steve
and
Ty.
And, even more delighted, because for the first time in the Cosmic Shed, I am joined by Tom Adams.
Hello.
Tom, who are you?
I am a friend, first of all, and I am a Margate-based performer and composer, and I'm a Gemini, and I'm really hot, and I'm happy to be here.
Hot
with
in the shed.
Ty and Steve, and you, Andrew. It's nice.
And,
what a beautiful day.
What claim have you got on Apollo?
I made a show about 3 or 4 years ago about Michael Collins, who was on board the Apollo 11.
Yeah.
He went around the moon on his own whilst Neil and Buzz went down to the surface, and I made a show about it which toured theatres. And then Andrew saw that and he said, "Do you want to do it in my van?" And I said, "Go away."
And, what an offer.
Yeah. And I said, "Yeah, no." First of all, I was like, "Yes, please." So we adapted that show to work in Andrew's camper van, Lionel. That show became the Apollo 11 camper van, and we did that at lots and lots of places. So I kind of know bits and bobs about it. But I like, you know, it's wasn't our aim this year? Our aim. We've been touring it for since like 2 years, and we thought, right, 2019, we're going to take it to America, take it, you know, Florida, you know, like Houston, everywhere like that. And here we are in a shed in Bristol, so it's perfect, you know.
Well, as it happens, the reason you're in Bristol is because we're rehearsing our new show, new show,
yeah,
The Lesser Sun,
yeah,
which is about the 400,000 people that NASA estimates it took to take humanity to the moon back in 1969, which is also slightly the topic of From the Earth to the Moon, which I love dearly. There's a lot of stuff at the moment, obviously, because it is the 50th anniversary, and for some reason, humanity seems to think a round number is interesting, when actually the fact that we went to the moon is interesting every day since we did it. People are weird, aren't they?
I think it's a very good excuse, if nothing else. Yeah. And I've certainly been ramping up my lunar scientific communication in the last couple of weeks.
You're doing something tomorrow.
Tomorrow, the 16th of July 2019, is the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11. Obviously, the landings came a few days later. And I am interviewing some of our postgraduates at the University of Bristol who are doing work with a company called Gravity Industries, who have made a working real-life jetpack.
That is insane.
It is so exciting.
We should do the Rocketeer.
Yeah. That's a good one. We should definitely... I've got footage, well, soundage, from them taking off and flying around at Gloucester Tall Ships Festival.
Cool.
I'll be putting something out on one of our student podcasts about that.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Unless you fancy editing it.
I really don't have time. I don't have time to edit this one, Steve. Bring a couple of them to the shed. Let's do the Rocketeer.
I will.
Brilliant. Ty.
Hi.
Tell us about From the Earth to the Moon.
Any of you who have seen Band of Brothers or The Pacific know that Tom Hanks, as well as being an actor, is a very big history nerd. He's also a massive space nerd, which anyone who's seen the behind the scenes of Apollo 13 will know. Basically, him and Ron Howard had such a good time doing Apollo 13 that 3 years after that, they collaborated again on From the Earth to the Moon, which was a 12-part HBO miniseries documenting essentially the whole Apollo project from the aftermath of Mercury and getting in the next 9 to Apollo 17.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Michael, HBO series, you know, They spared no expense. It's got an all-star cast. You'll be basically watching it going, oh, it's so-and-so. They've got Tony Goldwyn as Neil Armstrong. There's Bryan Cranston as Buzz Aldrin. Kerry Ulwes is Michael Collins. It's not bad having the Dread Pirate Roberts play the role that you also play.
I was up for that role too.
It's very close.
Annoyingly.
So the series is based on Andrew Chaikin's book, Man on the Moon. And each episode is about a different element of the missions, be it, you know, designing the lunar module to the Apollo 11 mission. In the case of Apollo 13, because they had already done that story in Apollo 13, that episode takes another look at what went on there, but from the point of view of the press and how the press reports on the Apollo missions. And so, of course, naturally, with the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, HBO have re-released the series on Blu-ray, tidied up the special effects. It's the first time it's been in HD.
And it looks amazing.
Yeah. So HBO have been very kind to supply us with four copies of the Blu-ray box set, which we will be running competitions on Facebook and Twitter.
We will.
I mean, we can't keep them all for ourselves.
No. We watch them all first.
Exactly. So just keep an eye on Facebook and Twitter, and there'll be details about how you can win a copy.
So obviously that's at The Cosmic Shed on Twitter, and just look for The Cosmic Shed on Facebook. If you find a sort of art museum in Texas, that's not us. We're the podcast.
Yeah, and then you can get to enjoy this wonderful anthology series with each episode introduced by Tom Hanks, space nerd.
It's so good.
And it's wonderful. It's a great miniseries, but, you know, it's one of many celebrations of Apollo 11 that's out this month. So Apollo 11, of course, the great documentary film that's been out. There's also Armstrong, that's narrated by Harrison Ford. And in Bristol, at the end of the month, as part of Cinema Rediscovered, The Watershed in Bristol is doing the UK premiere of For All Mankind, which you can see on the big screen.
That is awesome.
So if you're a space nerd, there are lots of things to see.
Just to say, Apollo 11, has everyone seen that?
Yes.
No, not yet.
Yes, it was bloody marvellous.
It's incredible, isn't it? I don't know quite how they did it, but they took the footage that we've seen and told the story that we know.
There was footage I had never seen before. I have no idea where they got some of this footage from.
But it's all existing footage. There's no special effects, no...
No, but it's kind of like... Because I've seen so many documentaries on Apollo 11. This was showing me stuff I'd never seen before.
But there's not even a sort of formal narrator. There's news recordings, but they tell a really, really nice, cohesive story without any
talking heads, footage, or narrator. It's amazing, yeah.
It's a phenomenal piece of filmmaking.
Watch it on a really big screen if you can.
Yeah, and there was First Man. We've done an episode all about First Man. You can go back and listen to that if you're interested in First Man. But also see First Man. That was great. Ty, you've done a couple of interviews.
I have. So since Andrew invited me on The Cosmic Shed, I've been trying to persuade him to do an episode on From the Earth to the Moon. We were going to do one last year, because obviously it was the 20th anniversary of the miniseries. Tom Hanks failed to reply to my email.
Oh, how rude.
Which is weird.
Thanks.
Ron Howard was busy directing Solo. So
good job, Ron.
Yeah. So I reached out to Graham Yost, who was the supervising producer. Graham, you might know, wrote certain films like Speed, and he produced films like Twister. And he, on From the Earth to the Moon, he wrote a couple of episodes, including the one that focuses on Apollo 11. And he also directed one of my favourite episodes, Spider, which focuses on how the lunar module was conceived and built and the entire process around that. So I reached out to Graham to talk to him all about his experiences on the project and how he got involved.
I was never going to be a rocket scientist, let's put it that way. But I was interested in the stories. And there was a toy that Mattel had that totally fixated me called Major Matt Mason. And it was about a military outpost on the moon. And I played with that incessantly. I got the moon base. My parents sprung for the whole moon base set, and it was just fantastic. I was just playing the basement with that for hours. I remember staying home from Google to watch the Voyager flybys, the first flybys of Jupiter and Saturn. I remember taking a moment when the first shuttle flight landed. And so I was always interested in space. So when, in 1996, I'd written three action movies in a row, we had been just shooting Hard Rain, which was originally called The Flood. Anyway, I got a call from my agent saying, Tom Hanks is doing a miniseries for HBO on the Apollo space program. Would you be interested? And I said, absolutely. I'll do anything I can to be involved with that.
So what made them think that the writer of Speed would be interested in not only writing an episode, but also producing the miniseries and also directing an episode? Was it something that you passionately fought for, or was it something that just came along as you got further and further into the project?
The latter. So I think they were interested in me just because I was a writer with credits. And my agent said, oh, he's interested. And they'd assigned most of the stories by then. But this is 1996. This is not 20 years later, where everyone wants to be in TV and you get all the great feature writers wanting to have their own shows and everyone wants to have a deal at Netflix and Amazon and Apple. And this was a different time. HBO hadn't done The Sopranos yet. They had done, you know, like Arliss and Dream On and a couple other shows. And it was just the beginning of time. I looked at the list of episodes. At that point, there were going to be 13. There was going to be a big one that Jonathan Feldman was going to write about the Russian space program. That became prohibitively expensive, so we never ended up doing that one. Of the episodes, there was only one or two left. I think one was episode 3, which was the return, basically the return of the program, you know, after the fire in Apollo 1. And it ended up being written by Randy Aubuchon, who was a friend, who was a great writer, who I actually brought into the whole thing. But there was that, and I think, well, that was going to be called Pad Rats at that time. It was going to be about the launch crew, about the launch tower crew and about their lives and stuff. It never ended up really being about that. But I said, boy, I'd love to do this one on the fire in Apollo 1. And they said, no, that's already assigned. I said, well, then I'll do this other one. And they said, fine. And then the next day they called me up and said, oh, he has to bow out. He can't write that. Do you still want to do it? I said, absolutely. And I jumped on that and wrote an outline. And I remember one of those life-changing things. I had no contact with Hanks yet and getting a phone call from him. He was in the editing room doing That Thing You Do, his first directorial debut. And he loved my outline and just was calling to say, job well done. And then I went at the script and they loved the script. And they said, would you be a supervising producer on this and help sort of shepherd the other scripts through and be a sort of, rewrite guy in house and stuff. And I said, yes. And then I did work on the first episode that Tom ended up throwing out. But then I did a lot of work on the Apollo 11 episode and a few other episodes. And then at one point, I just threw my hat in the ring. I said, I'd love to direct an episode. I'd love to do The Lem. It was entirely just Andy Wolk's script. That one just kind of got me. They said, okay, well, we'll think about it. And then we were having a big meeting in Tom's office, the production offices, and they had a big board up on the wall with all the episodes. The writer, the production date, all this stuff, director. And they said, look at the board. Is there anything there that you see that you want to talk about? And I didn't notice it at first. They had my name up as director of Hour 5. And they were like, come on, look at Hour 5. Look who's directing. And I said, holy shit. That was a big thing. That was a big, big thing in my life. The thing that I hit upon fairly early was that it should kind of be a detective story. And I stole the structure a little bit in a way from the movie Fearless by Peter Weir, in which there's a horrific plane crash. And it's about Jeff Bridges and others who survived the crash. And that film starts after the plane has landed, crash landed. And Jeff Bridges and a kid are running through a burning cornfield. And you don't see the plane crash until the last 20 minutes of the film. And I thought for Apollo 1, it was originally just called The Fire. I thought that we would start with the accident, but be outside it. And then that the whole story would be a detective story. What happened? And I thought that the detective should be Frank Borman. He was the astronaut in charge of finding out what happened. That said, there were thousands of people trying to find out what happened. I mean, it was, engineers just bawling their eyes out, trying to what killed these guys that they knew and they loved.
More from Graham later. Steve.
Andrew.
You've been watching From the Earth to the Moon for the first time recently.
I have. I've got up to episode 8, which is the Apollo 13 one. They're really varied in terms of... Because they've got different directors, haven't they? And different producers as well?
No, different directors. So it's a whole mixture of directors that, you know, bring in their own unique style. So the Apollo 12 one is directed by John Turteltaub, who did The Meg and The National Treasure. So his episodes are kind of, you know, different. Tom Hanks directed one. David Frankel, who I think did a couple of episodes of Band of Brothers, did one. Graham Yost did one. Frank Marshall, who did produce, like, the Jurassic World franchise.
There's some real big names in it, aren't there?
Real big names. And there's actors who I
recognise from things subsequently. Spider was one of my favourites as well, because I love the engineering side of the challenges that they went through. Who was the actor that played the project lead at Grumman?
Matt Craven.
And he's been in lots
been
of
in
stuff,
things like
he?
Crimson Tide and Timeline.
It's
and,
a good man to have in here, Ty, isn't it? I really liked the way that they portrayed the engineering process, the compromises and the sort of discoveries they made in order to make all of that happen.
Now, hatches. As it stands, we have two docking hatches. We can't afford the wait. I've been on the phone with Owen over at NASA and John Healy over at North American, and we all agree. We're going to go with just the one docking hatch up top and use a forward hatch for egress.
That means when they come back from the moon, they'll have to rendezvous on Dog Blind.
I know. We're going to put a window up top so the pilot can look up as he docks.
Another window? Geez, Tom, how much is that going to weigh?
I don't know. It's got to be less than a second docking hatch, right?
Tom, that will require the astronaut flying the limb to make a 90-degree change in axis. Left roll becomes left yaw, but left yaw becomes right
Arnold,
roll.
Arnold, astronauts are smart. We'll figure it out. Okay, apparently we're not done with the hatches. I just got off the phone with Pete Conrad. Because of the square backpacks, we're going to have to put in a square hatch.
Dave Scott was a consultant on the miniseries, and I talked to him. He's just a great guy. Oh, my God. I kept on looking at his feet and saying, those feet walked on the moon. I really got to know him better when we were all in Florida and just hanging out with him. And he would say things like, you know, it's really hard to judge distance on the moon. And I'm like, really, Dave? Because there are only 12 humans that know that. Dave gave me the nicest compliment I got on this whole thing, which he said, you really got the culture. You really got how we are, how the engineers are, how everything. And the truth of it is, it's just trying to give them all the benefit of the doubt. You know, they're smart people. They're trying to do the best they can. They'll have conflicts, but they're not, unless you find out that someone really was a jerk or an asshole, just they're doing the best they can. That doesn't mean they're not going to, you know, bang heads, but don't just go for easy conflict and try to make people smart, and especially in the space program. These guys are really smart. And they also had a sense of humor, and that's the other thing. So I think that's what Dave meant about the culture, and I think that's what Tom responded to as well.
I was initially a bit disappointed in the Apollo 13 episode because it's all on the ground. And obviously there's really interesting stuff that happened up in space. But now I realise that probably one of the motivations for that was that Tom Hanks, who executive produced and introduced all of the episodes and everything in From the Earth to the Moon, had been in a rather high-profile film 3 years before.
And Ron Howard
came out.
Also produced the series and had directed Apollo 13, so they're kind of like, well, collectively, we have done that story.
Yeah, that story is very much focused on what happened in the spacecraft throughout that episode. So they're obviously just taking
that.
A different take.
I love that they managed to find... I mean, that's kind of what me and Tom are doing, right? We're finding the other stories about Apollo.
Yeah.
So we're finding the Michael Collins story and then all the other stories that we're doing in The Lesser Sun, you know, kind of the hidden figures, if you like, and the hidden stories of Apollo, which is kind of interesting. And I love... That's one of the things that I love about From the Earth to Moon is that... Mm. things like that Apollo 13, where they've had to go, right, okay, there's this, we made this film. It's nice for them to be able to say, yeah, we made this film, which is a wonderful film in its own right. We've got an episode on Apollo 13, of course. That's where Fred Hayes appeared on The Cosmic Shed. You can go back into the archive for that. But it's that kind of looking at it from a different angle, because the other thing is the Mercury programme is barely covered in it, but that's because that was all covered in the right stuff.
Mm.
And they didn't want to tread over stories so that have gone before.
Gemini is covered in the first couple of episodes. Yeah. You see Dave Scott and Neil Armstrong's mission. But you're right about the different angles they take. So there's an episode that focuses on the wives of the astronauts and the kind of like the losses they go through and how divorce was very prevalent. And then there's a great episode, I think it's the 10th episode, which is basically all about a geologist that's brought in. Because when these astronauts on the moon, they have no idea what they're looking for. So he has to train Dave Scott and the rest of the Apollo 15 astronauts about what they're actually looking for on the moon that will be of interest.
Oh, that's
and that's kind of things that you don't actually consider. So he's taking them all out to, I think it's Death Valley or somewhere, and just taking them on geology trips. And, you know, they don't remotely give a shit at first until, you know, he's breaking it all down. And, you know, things that you never actually considered these astronauts would have to learn to do the missions that they did.
I haven't seen that episode yet, but one of the ones on the moon, they do spend a lot of time talking about a particular rock that they brought back.
Yeah.
Did they? Or was
the
that
Genesis
in...
rock.
No, sorry, yeah, it was on there, but it was also in a... Objectivity video that Brady Haran released recently. There were some videos about the vault that all of the moon rocks are kept in.
So good.
It's really, really excellent. We definitely need to
link to we'll link to that obviously on the website, thecosmicshed.com.
One other episode that really stuck out to me was about something that I didn't really know about. I knew it happened, but I didn't know any of the details. I think it was the second episode about the capsule fire.
Apollo 1, yeah.
Yeah, which they renamed, didn't they? It wasn't called an Apollo in the end, was it? But everyone calls it Apollo 1. And that was a real tragedy. Both they focused both on the aftermath and the politics and the sort of the blame game that went on afterwards. But they also went a great deal into the engineering challenges and the political and organisational and organizational challenges that led up to that, and then a bit about how they overcame it afterwards. That was absolutely fascinating. Obviously, hugely tragic.
Yeah.
But fascinating.
But it's also interesting because if that happened today, you could see Apollo getting scrapped completely.
Yeah.
But and that is discussed, and you see all the engineering companies, including Ronnie Cox, also in Born to Be Bad, out now. You know, thinking that his engineering company is going to be shut down because of it. Mm. And then Frank Borman has to make his testimony about what happened. But then you also see it from the astronaut's point of view.
Mm.
And Ed White's played by singer Chris Isaak, who's most famous for Wicked Game.
Mm.
That is a strange piece of casting.
Yeah.
But I love Chris Isaak.
Do you know, back in the MTV days when they used to show music and stuff, there was... they used to have takeovers of... there was a guy called Ray Cokes, I think he was called. He used to be a presenter on MTV. And Chris Isaak took over from Ray Cokes and did a documentary-like thing. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. So, yeah, I can't hear a bad word said about Chris Isaak.
One interesting thing that jumps out throughout is... I really appreciate the human endeavour, the financial and political sort of... coming together to make it all happen, and my biggest thing is the amazing feat of engineering that so many people did to get people to the moon. And you think, you wouldn't get people coming together like that these days. And then you take another step back, and they mention it frequently in the series. In the end, it was all a massive political dick swinging exercise. Yeah.
Yeah.
To get there before the Russians, and they're talking about how much of a disaster it will be for Russia to get there before us, and I'm wondering about how we harness the current political climate to
do some of this. Well, there's definitely a massive dick that we could get involved in this whole thing.
You're going to cut that?
Well, that massive dick was kind of like, how much money do I need to throw at NASA to get to Mars by, you know, 2022? And they were like,
all of it?
No.
You need to think beyond your political term.
Yeah, you can't just try and fit it into your political term. It's a much bigger thing than that.
This week, they've demoted the head of human spaceflight.
It's almost like he doesn't really know what he's doing.
At NASA, yeah.
When was Kennedy's speech? What year was we choose to go to the moon? Okay, so he was thinking...
61?
So he was definitely thinking beyond his 8 years of political term, or potential 8 years.
Potentially.
Played out
by the end of the decade.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Obama's the only one who came in and cancelled a space programme. You know, they always promise a space programme for the next term, because that's the thing to do, because then you don't have to deliver it. You just talk about the fact that it's going to happen. Trump, well, he's saying now you need to go to the moon. We're going to go to the moon, put the first woman and the next man on.
No, he doesn't want to do that because we've been to the moon and therefore there's no point in going back. Again, he fundamentally doesn't get why we need to go to the moon and also set up kind of...
You'll forgive me for being confused, because he said that we should go back to the moon and then a week later said the moon is part of Mars.
Yeah, but then he was also kind of like, it's a waste of time, he doesn't want to go back to the moon, that's been done.
Well, but anybody in their right mind who knows what it is to get somebody to the moon knows we can't do it by 2024. And so the people at the head of science in NASA have gone to Jim Bridenstine, whatever his name is, the climate-denying Trump appointee head of NASA, and said, we can't do that. We can't do that by 2024.
Why can't we, though? Because Blue did it in...
Yeah.
I don't think we have any Saturn V's lying around.
Yeah, they don't have the money to do it, and for other reasons, which we'll come to in a sec. But if they said, we need to get somebody on the moon again by 2024, and here's all the money to do that, then it becomes a reasonable thing. But what they're saying is, here's no extra money, or very little extra money, get somebody to the moon by 2024. They're then told by the scientists, we can't do that. And exactly the same way that they deny the science of climate change, they deny that and just demote that person. Utterly ridiculous.
In Armageddon, when there's an emergency, there are two like military space shuttles ready to go that somehow, don't ask me how because it's awesome, fly around the moon. On the back of the asteroid.
Yeah.
No military space shuttles could do this?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's that talk of the dark shuttle, isn't there, that's supposed to be...
Okay, I think we're now into, like, conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's okay. People are going to invade Area 51 and find out what's going on.
Yeah.
You up on that?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
That's an interesting question. Why can't we go back because we've already been there? And I think you've answered that question already by talking about Apollo 1, because the Apollo missions were in a particular time where the political will was to do it, and there is no way that three astronauts dying on the launch pad or on a test bed for a moon program now would just be effectively brushed over the way it was with Apollo 1.
Okay, it was do it at any cost then. Obviously not
at any cost.
Astronauts dying routine, like Elliot C. He was just flying from one point to another and his plane crashed into a hangar roof in heavy fog. You're just astronauts dying through accidents, let alone, like, plugs out tests.
Gus Grissom was the first astronaut to be asked to fly three times. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. He loved being an astronaut. Except for the publicity and being on display that comes with the job. There are no front windows on the house he built for Betty in Timber Cove because he didn't want people looking in. Now, if that gives you the impression that Gus was a cranky SOB, well, he was at times. But I would have trusted him with my life. Ed White was a big man for an astronaut, shade under 6 feet, exceptional athlete. As you all know, Ed was the first American to walk in space. There was a story going around that when he was on a spacewalk, he stayed out after he'd been ordered in because he was having such a good time. It's a funny story, but it would have meant that Ed White disobeyed an order. Not going to happen. Ed was a West Point man. And duty, honor, country aren't just words to him. They were him. He's one of my closest friends. Roger Chaffee, I didn't know that well. He was one of the new guys. Very energetic, very excited. I heard a story about him, though. He was out on Long Island visiting the Grumman facility where they're building the descent stage for the lunar module. And he saw a group of men standing in a corner. Well, he found out these were the fellas that make the tools, that make the machines. None of the bigwigs being escorted through there ever talked to these guys. But Roger went over and made them feel like they were the most important part of the program.
Obviously, Graham Yost, the executive producer on hit series like Justified and The Americans, and you've also written famous action films like Speed, Broken Arrow, and Hard Rain, but you were also a supervising producer on From the Earth to the Moon. So you co-wrote the Apollo 11 episode along with Tom Hanks, as it turned out. The one thing that fascinates me about that episode, and something that I didn't know before I saw that episode many years ago, was the conflict between Armstrong and Aldrin over whether to do something on the moon, maybe from a more religious point of view, and also that, not resentment, but kind of Buzz wanting to also be the first man on the moon, which is a very natural thing to want. Did you talk to Armstrong and Aldrin about it?
Never talked to Armstrong. I never met him. Dave Scott would say nothing but the nicest and most. He loved Armstrong. Well, first of all, Armstrong saved his life in Gemini 8. You know, he figured the trick out. He figured out how to save their lives. Dave was just, you know, and he always said that Armstrong was the best pick, and everyone kind of knew it, that he would get the first landing. The stuff about Buzz, it's in the book. It sort of materialized that was a natural conflict. And when we found out that Buzz was pushing to get out first, because, you know, his argument about the way the hatch opened, and Neil basically saying, I'll think about it. And then I think it was Slayton. I haven't seen Earth to the Moon in a long time, but I think it's Nick Searcy playing Slayton, who says, yeah, Neil's the commander. He's getting out first. You know, that's just the way it's going to be, Buzz. And Buzz is, you know, he's an interesting guy. I've only met him once.
Yeah.
To go to the White House to screen an episode of this thing. And, you know, he's had many different passions in his life, focuses, and I think would get intensely into things. So he had sort of a religious thing then, which I don't know if he's kept his entire life. And obviously a much more public figure than Neil. Armstrong made the choice to not talk to anyone. He just had a private life after that. Except for, you know, like the 40th anniversary and things, and he would give talks occasionally, but he was not, he sort of made his deal, which is, I will do the tours, I will do I will shake the hands of the world leaders, I'll take the ticker tape, and then it's my life. Without being a jerk about it, it was just kind of, that's kind of who he was.
Yeah, I've always been interested in From the Earth to the Moon's more sullen approach to Aldrin, and more recently, First Man's approach was that he was a bit of a dick.
Right.
It's just
The Corey Stoll version, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there was elements to that, but those of us who worked on Earth and the Moon saw First Man and we go, oh, we liked our version better. And but I liked First Man, and I know Josh Singer, and he's a great writer, and I think Chazelle is a great director. And there's some big, bold choices in that thing that are very artistic. I don't know if they're as emotional just telling the story might have been. But, and I can't say anything due to my heritage as a Canadian. I'm not allowed to say anything negative ever about Ryan Gosling or Ryan Reynolds, or in fact, anyone named Ryan. That's just the way it goes. But no, I love Gosling, and I thought he was a good Neil. But I thought Tony was great as Neil Armstrong. From what I heard from Dave Scott, that Armstrong had a very quiet sense of humor. And he, he's an engineer more than anything. So he had that sort of reserve that now the term is, well, he's on the spectrum. Well, I don't know, but he's an engineer. And he, that the one way he showed just this modicum of affection was he really liked Michael Collins. And he would, everyone called him Mike, but Armstrong called him Michael. And it was just that little difference. I'm going to call you Michael, and that shows how much you mean to me. It seems teeny tiny, but we know that in human interaction. If, you know, there's certain people you call by their last name, and that's the little bond. You've got that affection.
Obviously, you're one of three writers on that episode. What's it like hammering out that story, especially with Tom Hanks, who was one of the overall producers on the miniseries? Did you clash on any elements of that story, or was pretty much everyone, you know, set with the story you were going to tell?
You know, my little math about having worked with Tom on three or four things, actually five, but one never got produced, but is that we agree about 80% of the time. Of the remaining 20%, 10%, he's right, 5% I'm right, and 5% just doesn't matter, you know? And so that's pretty good math. The big stuff that I would do, he pretty much, you know, liked. But for example, I did a pass on the first episode and I had Kennedy as a character. And Tom said, we are not doing that. We are not going to show the president of the United States. I said, okay. I felt that I wanted to get in Kennedy's head with Ted Sorensen and the decision to make this bold gesture of we'll go to the moon in this decade. You know, I don't know why he didn't say decade, but he says decade in the Rice speech. But anyway, Tom said, yeah, we're not doing that. So I was like, okay. On Tranquility, is it called Tranquility Base for the episode, or Tranquility?
Well, it's the Latin.
Mara Tranquillitatis or something.
Yeah.
It was only toward the end of, like, we're looking at it, and Tom said, we should have called it The Second Man. And it should have just been about Buzz. I think the episode still works, and I think it works well, but it is a little bit more general about the thing. It's about Neil, it's about Buzz, it's about Mike Collins to a degree, it's about the whole, the problems and all of that. I think the landing sequence was really, I think Frank did a great job. And Frank, by the way, was a friend from before that. We met in a running group in LA, so I'd known Frank for years. I think he did a crackerjack job through the whole episode.
So obviously you went on and worked with Tom Hanks again on Band of Brothers, The Pacific, John Adams, all HBO miniseries that I love. Obviously, we're talking about From the Earth to the Moon, but briefly, can you just tell me what it was like working on those epic productions? Because they're incredible.
Well, they just continue to get more epic. Earth to the Moon, everyone remembers it differently. I remembered it being about 65 million. I know Band was about 120, and then Pacific is 200, and now The Mighty Eighth is going to be maybe half a billion. So, I mean, just now, I'm not involved with that. But on the other hand, when we were doing Pacific, I remember thinking, God, we're spending $200 million on this thing. And then I realized, yeah, well, the last Harry Potter movie cost $220. You know, so it's like, that's what things cost these days.
But that's not the only interview you did for this episode.
No, so we're all friends here on this podcast, so let's be truthful. The interview you're about to listen to, I did a couple of years ago. So when I was writing my book, Born to be Bad, Talking to the Greatest Villains in Action Cinema, out now.
Available from all good bookshops. And Amazon. And,
well, yes, and large evil corporations. Got to earn a living. I interviewed Paul McCrane, who some of you will know as playing Emil in RoboCop, who gets, you know, crashes into a toxic vat and melts. He was also in ER. He was also in 24 as Graham Bauer. He's also in From the Earth to the Moon as Pete Conrad, the mission commander of Apollo 12. The Apollo 12 episode basically is narrated by Al Bean, or the character, or the astronaut of Al Bean. And it's a very different relationship that these three astronauts have compared to the Apollo 11 crew. So when I was interviewing Paul for my book, I kind of rounded off the interview by just asking him about From the Earth to the Moon, because it was a show that I loved so much. And he was very happy to talk about it.
What are your memories of doing that show? Because obviously it was an HBO show. The budget was incredible. You've got the likes of Bryan Cranston as Buzz Aldrin, you got Tony Goldwyn as Neil Armstrong, and you obviously were Pete Conrad. And what was your experiences of making that show?
It was fantastic. I have to say, I was actually brought in late. Someone else had the role. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure who it was, but they had, in relatively short notice, had to drop out. And I was invited to come and do Pete Conrad. And it was great, great fun. That episode, the experience of the whole thing, but particularly that episode, was a lot of fun. John Turteltaub directed it, and he was just exceptional. And made it a lot of fun and took this whole, I remember him saying things like, you know, the previous Apollo mission had been the big one that was like getting all the attention.
Yeah.
This was sort of like the aftermath and people weren't quite paying as much attention to it. So these guys, first of all, it was about their relationship. These three guys really liked each other and really had fun together. And so his whole tack was that this was like the most adventurous, expensive summer camp with three buddies could go on. And that's what we leaned into when we were doing it. So it was great fun. And as somebody who grew up in the 60s with NASA being something that was fascinating, to have a guy like Dave Scott, he was a technical advisor, and we had access to like transcripts of like the comms, the communications between mission control and the astronauts and all that stuff. You could read them. It was just great. And the sets that we had, what were the command modules, they were larger than scale. They were slightly scaled up. But they actually were very accurate in terms of the things that were there. And to be able to talk with him and learn about stuff that they went through and do all that kind of stuff, and then work with John, who's such a good guy and such a smart director and such a funny guy, who kept that spirit of play. And, of course, you know, Dave Foley and Tom Varica, who are great guys, they're still friends. It just, the whole experience was really fun. And they were so dedicated, the whole production was so dedicated to doing it in both an accurate way and a fun way. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, these guys, I mean, they didn't know how to do any of this. When Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, nobody had to know how to do any of this. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. One of the things I love the best hearing about, I'm going to absolutely get this wrong, but the gist of it is right. You know, there was a period of time where they figured out how to get people to the moon, but they couldn't figure out how to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a brief while, this is how crazy everybody was trying to accomplish this. They said, okay, why don't we send them up and we'll just keep sending them supplies till we can figure out how to get them back. which the astronauts themselves said, no, I don't think we're going to be doing that. But the other thing was the command module, the onboard memory, the state of the art at that time. I can't remember what it was. Somebody will tell me more accurately, but it was some ridiculously small amount, like 27K.
Yeah.
There was something like that. So the way they did it was they would radio up commands. They would execute the commands. They would dump the memory, and then they'd radio up commands for the next thing. I mean, the fact that they even got there at all with so little, you know, obviously there was some tragic loss of life in the Apollo program,
yeah,
or in the space program, but that there was so little is an extraordinary thing. And one of the other things I learned doing that, you know, when you look at mission control and you see each of those banks of monitors and phones where that this area is in charge of this system and that area is in charge of that system. As I recall, they said each one of those had a phone and you could pick up that phone and it immediately rang to somewhere at Mission Control or JPL or someplace where some of the engineers would be staffed 24 hours a day with engineers that had worked on that system. And from that phone, they had people staffed at the manufacturer 24 hours a day during a mission so that in a matter of 60 seconds, you could get back down to the guy who actually cut the bolt to talk about any system on that thing. The level of detailed design support, I mean, it's just extraordinary. So for a bit of a science nerd that I am and somebody who grew up in Apollo, it was just an extraordinary opportunity and a whole lot of fun.
I mean, it takes a special kind of person to do that. I mean, someone like Pete Conrad, you know, he was a test pilot, a naval aviator. But the way you portray him in the film as that down-to-earth guy who just loves his fellow astronauts and who's completely the polar opposite to Neil Armstrong. I mean, Conrad's first word while landing on the moon was whoopee, which is...
you know, I got the one of the other great things about it is that I think it was just before, just after it was released, we actually got to have a dinner with the actual three guys. And it was just extraordinary because P. Conrad, you know, he really was that guy. He was just kind of a fun, from the, I didn't know him well. I can't claim to have, I don't pretend to, but from everything I read about him, and I did read a lot about him, and having met him, he kind of was like a fun-loving guy, extraordinarily smart, but liked to have a good time, liked to goof around. He talked about, as I recall, his scariest thing actually didn't have anything to do with Apollo at all. If I remember right, he was in one of the early shuttle missions, and they had the the robot arm that he was attached to, and it got, I'm trying to remember this right, you can look this story up just for yourself, I don't know if it's anything to your writing, but he said the scariest time for him in space was that the robot arm was like stuck somehow, and he was on it, and they worked it free, and he got like, there had been built up stress on it, and it flung him out into space like a bow and arrow. And if it wasn't for the tether that he was on, he was gone, man. He was like, that was it. Those guys were exceptional. As you said, it takes an exceptional person. And these three guys in particular apparently really did have the reputation of being buddies and really having a good time together. And there was a kind of a bond among them that was, each one of these crews, of course, has that kind of thing. But there was something unique about this one. And I think that's what makes that particular episode a lot of fun to watch.
And it's great that you got to meet him, because I think Captain Conrad died the year after the miniseries came out. So it's great that you
a year or two after. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
How did you find the zero G scenes?
We really wanted to try and do the, do that stuff on the Vomit Comet, the plane that actually they train on. We didn't. We actually, those were all on stage, and they were all with, wires or different arranged things. And very cleverly done, I thought. So unfortunately, I can't. It wasn't like the guys on Apollo 13, Kevin Bacon and those, and Pullman and Hanks, who actually went on the Vomit Comet to shoot some of those scenes. We didn't do that.
Oh, that's a shame. I was going to ask you if you did.
Yeah, no, for a brief moment, there were conversations about that happening, and I was really looking forward to it. I'd love to go on that parabolic plane, but we didn't get to do that.
Paul, that's great. Thank you so much for doing this.
Likewise, really enjoyed it. Take good care.
You too. Thank you.
Okay. Bye now.
So we were just watching to test out the new Blu-ray, which I have to say again, looks amazing.
Because the regular DVD looks a bit rubbish, the graphics.
Reworked all the, I don't know what they've done, but it looks incredible.
Well, I was quite impressed with the sort of visuals on it. Certainly the stuff of the landers and that is, they've got some big sets.
Yeah, oh, totally. But it's just HD and beautiful now.
Yeah.
I think it's because when it was first made, it was meant to be for, not widescreen TVs. It's 4x3 format. And then when it was released on DVD, they kind of stretched it out, but they didn't really remaster it.
Are they remastered from the original analogue then? Or
it would look like it. They've definitely cleaned up the special effects and remastered it for HD.
Fair play. Beautiful. They've not rendered all of the practical stuff, because I really liked the practical.
I'm not sure. There's a featurette on what they've done to remaster it.
Cool. But there's in the episode we were looking at, they're juxtaposing the news footage of Vietnam and Martin Luther King being shot and etc. with what was going on with the scientists at NASA, and that is in a similar way in episode 12, they juxtapose the story with a reenactment of the film, the making of the film, the Georges Méliès film, Voyage to the Moon.
That's the one with the custard pie face and the rocket in his eye, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, so they reenact how they made that film?
Yes.
Wow. With Bryan Cranston.
No, Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks.
Really?
Yeah, that episode, yeah.
So that is kind of quite... They've just gone for it.
It's totally out there.
They're
it's
just getting like, rid of all their
budget. It's like we're going back to the early 1900s.
Oh, I should have continued. I'm sorry.
Spend it all on whipped cream.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece of television that got made, and I love it. Right, listen, let's listen to Fred Hayes, who was on Apollo 13.
Over 40 years after the flight, I finally got around to listening to some of the inner room loop. All the public heard was the Capcom talking to the capsule, talking to us back and forth. But there was a number of loops for the various specialties in the room that went to another room out of Mission Control along the hallway. That was some of their backups, if you will, the people that were also knowledgeable about the systems. The unusual thing about our situation that was different, normally you would say we can handle anything, and certainly when somebody like Gene Kranz, any flight director, gave a go for launch, they really had this team behind them that was geared and honed and trained through a lot of simulations to face what they had to do during the mission. That credo that was created really by Hollywood scriptwriter Bayer is not an option was kind of the way we really felt. But the most things we had trained were what we called possible failures, credible failures. And we had one that was credible, but the results through all the FEMA, failure mean effects analysis, and the design with reliability engineering said if you ever had an explosion, you were going to lose the vehicle and you'd lose the crew. So we kind of gave them a problem. We were sitting there still breathing. And even Mission Control did. For most of the contingencies that applied to their systems, they could reach behind them and grab a book or even several books that would help them walk through what they had to do to mitigate that problem. Well, there was no book for this set of problems we had. So they were really having an adventure to fly. And as I listened to those voices now, I try to work through, and it really was real-time conversation, was really expressed the knowledge they had in their heads about the system, the workings of the systems, and they desperately were trying to isolate the leak in the second oxygen tank. If we not had that leak in the second oxygen tank, we still would have not landed, but we'd have aborted still. We'd have come home, but fully powered up, and it would have been really a fairly normal mission, except the fact we didn't land. So they were working through things and pretty desperate, shutting off reactant valves, which is to flow to some of the fuel cells. They thought even a leak might be backwards through one of the fuel cells that wasn't producing electricity. But they finally had to give up the ghost. And you could hear I knew the people, and I could tell the inflection in their voices that they had lost the battle. They'd run out of ideas. But Glenn Lunny, the flight director at that point, they shifted right in the middle of all of this. Gene Kranz went off with his white team, and Glenn Lunny had come on with the maroon team. And he called them back to attention and said, hey, we got to get this thing shut down, and shut down fast. Because at the point, only one fuel cell was functioning, and we were partially eating into the small entry batteries, the batteries we were going to need when we got back for entry. So anyway, just that quickly, the voice changed, and now they had another problem, though. The command module, the mothership, we called it, was never supposed to be shut down in flight. So there was no procedure. They couldn't reach behind them and get the book on how to shut this thing down. And they had to do it in a graceful way to assure they didn't damage something in that process. But same thing went on now, just ad-libbing with their backroom experts. They worked through a sequence. But at any rate, this was a story, like I said, I had not known about until I listened to those inner-room voice tapes.
Try again. Go ahead.
We've had a hard Houston, say again, please.
I don't know what it was.
Okay. GNC, you want to look at it?
Yeah, Houston, we've had a problem.
The one thing I have to say about From the Earth to the Moon is that the theme tune is West Wing-esque. in its beauty.
It's Michael Kamen who did Band of Brothers and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and wow. Die Hard.
How do you know so much, Ty?
It's because I know so little about everything. are massive gaps I know nothing about. So.
So Alan Bean was on Apollo 12. Alan, when he walked on the moon, he walked, came down the ladder and turned towards the sun and fried the film in his Hasselblad camera that was strapped to his front. He went around the moon taking photos, thinking he was taking photos, and of course he'd fried the film, so when he got back to Earth, he discovered that he didn't have any photos of his experience on the moon.
I mean, for all conspiracy theorists, that is just kind of like... Yeah. It's just kind of like, well, if they had faked it, you would have photos, but because of human nature, he fucked it.
When he retired from being an astronaut, he became an artist, painting nothing but his experience on the moon and the experience that the other astronauts had in the Apollo program, getting to, around and onto the surface of the moon.
When they started assigning people to Apollo and Skylab, they assigned me to Skylab. I wanted to be on Apollo, but I was sent to Skylab. And then Pete Conrad had a crew that was Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and a fellow by the a Marine by the name of C.C. Williams. And so they went along in training for a while, and I went along over on Skylab for a while, and then C.C. Williams got killed in an airplane crash. And so then Pete requested that they, you know, Deke come over and get me from Skylab and put him on his crew, which I thought was a great idea, even though I had never thought it would happen. It wasn't something I thought would happen. But anyway, it did. And so when we made up our patch, our Apollo 12 patch, we put four stars up in the sky. And then when we went to the moon, then we took one of those patches, and then I had asked C.C. Williams' wife, widow, for his wings that he earned as a Marine pilot, and we took those to the moon. And then right at the end of our EVA, Pete and I went over near Surveyor Crater, and we put his wings down in an Apollo 12 patch near there. And then in the painting that I'm just finishing up, I'm leaning over and kind of tossing them down. And then Pete's standing over to my left where you are, and he's saluting. And then I've stepped back, not in the painting, but then I stepped back and saluted. And we left those there. And so my guess is that the wings are there perfect as the day that I left them and will be for millions of years. They'll be beautiful gold pilot wings. And the patch, I wondered, I think with that ultraviolet rays coming in from the sun a lot, maybe it's faded. I don't really know, but I'm guessing it's faded. It'll be there as cloth, but it won't last. And I took a lot of things for friends. One of my friends, who was kind of smart, gave me a locket that his wife could have, and in the locket you opened it up and there was a picture of all their family. Each had a number of things like that. So his comment was, and her, was, I was taking their family to the moon. So that was a clever idea. And I took a lot of things like that. People would ask, and I would say, I didn't have time to think about all this. You're busy trying to learn to fly to the moon and back correctly. Stay alive. That's on your mind. The rest is, if I can do it, I'll do it. And so we did, and the curious thing about it is a lot of the things I had no idea, they said, would you take it? I said, yes. I never saw it again, probably. Don't know what it was, and didn't think about it at all. So I get back from the flight, and then I've got all this stuff, and the kids, I look at it, and then people would come up and say, well, Alan, did you bring back the locket? Yeah. Well, sure. here it is. I ended up with about four or five different things that I took for somebody that I still have in a safe deposit box because I have no idea who the heck they look for, or even if they ask me, and I've often laughed about it. There's somebody, five people out there saying, that guy took it to the moon and never gave it back. Well, yeah, but I didn't. I still got them. Yeah. So if they ever would show up and tell me what it is, I would go to my safety deposit box and find it and give it to them. So that's kind of part of it, too. You don't have time to think about these things. No. You got to learn the things that are life and death. You've got to find a way to get there and back alive. And that's on your mind, and anything else is just extra. And you do it if you can. But you don't think about it. You don't have it on your mind. I had none of that on my mind. I didn't have art on my mind. If I had, I would have taken a nice sheet of watercolor paper about this size and two or three acrylic brushes. The night I had time to do it, night I would have lifted the shade there on the limb and done a little sketch. First art ever done on the moon. It would be great. Never thought of it. Well, never thought of it.
We have to go
back. Didn't think of any of it in Skylab either. You get involved in these things and you, I'm a single-minded person. And so I kind of do things, and I'm not a multitask person. When I'm here, I'm thinking about giving good speeches. I don't think about art, but I will be when I get on that plane going home.
I just love the Apollo missions. They make me so happy, and I think that's why From the Earth to the Moon, shining a light on just an amazing bit of humanity that, you know, as we said, there's 400,000 people it took to take us to the moon, and any light shone on them, a beautiful thing that should be celebrated.
But the work that's still ongoing is amazing as well. We're still learning about how the moon was formed, about the geology and the history of everything that the moon's been through, and the people that are still curating that archive, sending out samples to researchers, and the researchers that are doing current work on it. It's amazing how many people it's still involving.
Yeah.
And the recent BBC series The Planets did a great episode on the Earth and the Moon.
I haven't watched that whole series yet. Need to get involved in that.
That's good. It's good.
No, it's very good stuff.
It's science porn.
Pluto is beautiful. Far from being a frigid, featureless world, it turns out that it has all the characteristics of a dynamic, living planet.
Pure, unadulterated, R-rated science porn. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
People like Graham Yost and Tony Toe, who are producers on the thing, they're also massive space and history geeks. When I met Graham, his love of the subject and working on Band of Brothers was palpable. We kind of had a little bit of a geek out.
Last week, I visited the set of Ron Moore's new show for Apple, For All Mankind. Do you know about this?
I've heard about it. I've heard it's what he's doing as well as Outlander, but I don't know what it's about specifically.
You know what? I'm not going to spoil it, but I will just say I did stand in the LEM cockpit, and it was the same one we used 20 years ago.
This is going to be a weird question, but where did the Great Escape theme and motif come from?
It started with the baseball glove and the ball.
Okay.
I wanted Tom to go outside. I just like the idea of people in these situations. It's like I had an office with the writer Clyde Phillips, who did 4 years of Dexter and Nurse Jackie, great writer, showrunner. We shared an office suite. And we developed a game that we called Ledge Bag, where we would take these juggling bags, stand against one wall, and try and get it on this narrow ledge along the window. And we just played that for hours. And I like the idea that people will just come up with games. They'll come up with ways. And I thought that Tom Kelly throwing a ball against the wall was a way to have him go out. And instead of smoking, that he would go out and do this thing that would let him think and would take his mind off it. And both think and take his mind off, sort of a meditative thing. So it was that. It started with a ball, and I thought, well, who else threw a ball? It was Steve McQueen in Great Escape. That then went into that. You know, then the shot I'm most proud of, which was, you know, at the end of the last time you're at Grumman pulling up and seeing all the balls on the roof.
It's tempting to think of the Apollo missions as just a triumph of science and exploration. And that's what I want to think of them as. But it's equally viable, of course, to think of them as just a weird quirk of the political situation and the Cold War at the time.
Well, I can't remember where I read it, but a year or two ago, someone was projecting where we would be if the moon missions hadn't happened. If you take first manned spaceflight and steady progress, Apollo is this huge, outsized blip in sort of exponential, hugely funded progress. And right now, if you ignore that and draw a straight line of scientific progress, yeah, we're about where we would be if Apollo hadn't happened.
Yeah, because what, Apollo was 50 years after the Wright brothers? How many years after?
Brothers were 1907?
Okay, so 62 years. That's incredible, just thinking you're going from, manned flight to the moon.
Yeah.
And just 50 years later, we haven't left, you know, the sub-orbit since 1972.
Yeah. I've done some interviews with people who are involved in science and exploration, because for me, that's what I want to believe Apollo is about. But this episode is going to be too long with those in, so I'm going to do a separate episode with three people who are involved in science and exploration now. One is friend of the shed, Mikhaila Mosilova, who is now director of the High Seas Project in Hawaii, which is the...
That's just an awesome job title.
Yeah, but what she does is she's director of this... it's an analogue version of Moon and Mars missions, and she's looking after that, where people go and do what astronauts would do if they were going to Mars. Sort of like NASA, ESA, all over the place. Anyway, that's on that episode. We've also got Emma Brisdian, who's in the Arctic, looking at ways that we can study climate change by doing things like climbing a mountain and putting a little pod on the mountain that makes the stuff under it 1 degree warmer. So you can see what would happen if it was 1 degree warmer, which is clearly going to happen with the way that we are changing the climate. And we've got Lizzie Daly from, you might know her from BBC TV. She was on the BBC Blue Planet 2 series things. She's done some Animal Planet things. And she's doing some actual science. She's going out and studying elephant and human conflict and doing a PhD in that. So that's quite a nice little episode, companion episode to this one.
Elephant and human conflict.
The elephants win, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. They don't, weirdly. So that's that. And, let's have a little bit more Graham Yost.
So what were the challenges that you faced in kind of putting your own unique stamp on an episode that's in a mini-series that's got to have an overall feeling to it?
Well, that was Tom's real goal from the whole thing, was that each hour would feel like it was a little movie about one particular part of the Apollo program. I remember that during the Emmy season, we got kind of attacked by other miniseries people saying, that's not a miniseries, that's an anthology. And it's like, well, okay, but it's not a series, but it is anyway.
And then you just held up your Emmy and went,
we'll take it. Well, we're all right with it. There were continuing characters and all of that stuff, but they really were independent stories. And Tom, and Ron Howard, Ron and Tom were the partners, and Brian Grazer, all part of this thing, really allowed the writers and directors to have their own sort of imprint on each story. Encouraged that. For Spider, I knew early on that I was going to direct it, so I came up with ideas, and one was that I wanted to have voiceover, because I felt that narration could help us get through some rough patches pretty fast, and, you know, just get the exposition done without having a clunky scene. Interview with Kubrick asking why he used, like I'm comparing myself to Stanley Kubrick, but he was asked why he used narration in Barry Lyndon. And he said, so I don't have someone on the ship saying, well, we've been at sea these last 11 months and, you know, and clunky stuff like that. So I had narration, but in my first drafts, the narrator was the Lem.
Really?
It was she narrating it in a human voice, but talking from what it knew and about engineering and about, and it was a bold choice that ultimately was ridiculous. So, you know, we were like 2 weeks before production and the decision came down that I was to take out the narration. And it was like, ah, God. So I had to reconfigure the thing. But in the back of my mind, I knew, well, we could probably narrate it in post. We could figure out a way to do it then. And that's when I realized, oh, of course, it's Tom Kelly's story. Let Tom be the narrator. And I like the idea of, and I felt the episode worked, that you hear this, you have this faceless narrator. And it's Matt Craven, who's known, but not, you know, at that point, not that identifiable. And you hear this voice, and then you see his face, and you realize, oh, that's our narrator. Now we're in the story, and now we're with him. And we've been with him from the beginning, but he's been giving this historical perspective. Now we're going to be with him for the rest of it. Focusing on the engineering, because it's creativity. I think that's the other thing, is that we think of engineers as just slide rules and numbers and calculations. And there's an incredible amount of creativity that went into designing the Lem, and then, you know, and then they've got all their systems and how to test it and make sure that the leg would work under these circumstances, and, you know, so on and so forth.
Every Lem would have to be handmade. There was no supplier to order Lem parts from, and because everything on a Lem was new, everything had to be tested and tested and tested again. The thrusters, the engines, the deployment of the landing gear. We had to know how a Lem would react when exposed to intense sunlight or when pelted with dust. We had to know how the landing gear would perform if a Lem came down on a slope. Thousands of tests, day after day, for years. Some of the tests went well, and some did not.
Hey, we did it. We're proud of it. And hopefully people will rediscover it at some point.
I think it's just one of those projects that brought together people that genuinely cared about what they were doing. Mm. And because of that, you have something incredibly unique.
I definitely recommend people watch it. There's some episodes that I'm not so keen on, but as a whole, absolutely fantastic.
Okay.
Well, I personally believe that if me and Tom Hanks ever met face-to-face, we'd be best friends due to our mutual love of space and history and war films. Though he collects typewriters. Not really a typewriter guy. But I think if you love Band of Brothers, the Pacific, Apollo 13, then you would love From Earth to the Moon.
Thanks, Tom Hanks.
And before we go, Tom, please can you sing us a song?
I'd love to. This was a song from the show, the Apollo 11 Campervan, and it's sung by Michael Collins. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin have just left the command module. They've gone down to the surface, and now Michael Collins is on his own, orbiting the moon, and he's really happy. I'm pushing buttons, I'm flicking switches, scratching the spaceship whenever it itches. Being on my own is great. I was about to strangle Buzz. The moon is my view. It
It's not just a disc, but a three-dimensional spectacle. From my home, I'm so far in something the size of a family car. But it's quite roomy, actually, with the zero-G. Zero-G. And the moon. Is my view. It's not just a disc, but a three-dimensional spectacle.
Thanks, Tom. Right, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at The Cosmic Shed.
And Facebook.
And Facebook, where we will be giving away four copies of the new Blu-ray of From the Earth to the Moon. It's amazing from start to finish. It does look amazing on the Blu-ray. And thank you very much to... Who's given us those to give away?
HBO UK.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Thanks, HBO UK. And that sounded insincere. I genuinely love that they did that. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to Steve, Ty and Tom for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed.
Thank you.
And look out for that companion episode.
Look at that. That's beautiful. This has got to be one of the most proud moments of my life, I guarantee you.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.